they said the words with care. They saw that the final phrase in the Shir Shel Yom is L'chuna Ranana. Come, let us praise God. And that is also the opening phrase in our prayers on Friday night. And therefore, Wednesday morning, you're already preparing for Shabbos. Can't make Havdalah anymore on Wednesday morning. And so we're already starting anew, not just preparing for Shabbos this week, but we're preparing now, we're starting a new program. The program, again, is called L'chuna Ranana. And it is dedicated in loving memory of our own Rebbetzin Evelyn Rothman, et Habas Reb Alexander Ziskin, Zichrono Livracha. The provisions are being sponsored by Rabbi Rothman in memory of Rebbetzin Evelyn. And there will be an entire year of studies. Bring your friends. There are a few extra seats available, and we'll try to have better service at the door going forward. We are being videoed this morning by Torah Anytime, and if there's anybody that is interested in watching beautiful Torah lectures from more than 150 different lecturers from around the world, you can go to TorahAnytime.com. The first class, over the course of the next 9 weeks, will be delivered by Rabbi Schaffer on the topic of scrolling through Megillat Esther, an entirely different viewpoint than you may have had before. And I want to thank Rabbi Schaffer not only for being the lecturer, the first lecturer of this program, but for inspiring and coming forth with the idea for having this weekly opportunity for men and women in our community. I'm hoping this will be the beginning of that we'll need a bigger room soon. But this is a very good first start, and with no further ado, for the first class, it is my honor to call upon Rabbi Schaffer.
Okay, good morning everybody, Boker Tov. Just a little bit of intro as to what we're doing here, and also a little bit about why I chose this particular topic. Tell you the story. I had the privilege, I think Rabbi Epstein also had this particular privilege in his own experience, particularly in Eretz Yisrael. I had the privilege in England of meeting what I call Gedol Yisrael, great rabbis, the real deal. And my Rosh Yeshiva, Leib Gurevitch, Zichron Livracha, one of the really outstanding Talmidei Chachamim in the world, passed away in 1982. What happened was that he lived across the road from the yeshiva, and his front room was his learning room. So in the summer in England, as any of you have been to England will know, Shabbos goes out at a horrendous time. It's usually after 11. Imagine Shabbos, 11:30 at night. I mean, it's really, I don't know how we did it, but we did it. And every night the yeshiva used to daven Maariv at 11 o'clock. That was the Maariv time. And we came out of the yeshiva 11:20, 11:25, and across the road, the Rosh Yeshiva is sitting there, and he's got his sefer open. And he's already a man, when I was in the yeshiva, he was already well into his 70s, he'd come from Eastern Europe, he'd learned with the great rabbis of the pre-war generation, and he's sitting there studying 11:30, 11:45 at night. And we asked the obvious question, that, you know, he knows it all, what is he doing? Why doesn't he go to sleep? And we asked him once, Reb Leib, why do you do this? And his answer was, not because he's trying to pat himself on the shoulder, not trying to say that, you know, this is something which he's looking for, as he would say, for brownie points or whatever. He's doing it because he wants the Bokrim to know there's never, ever a time in your life when you should not be learning. Even if you get to a stage, as they call it in this country, the golden years, the years after you retire, the years after supposedly when things are more time in your hands, etc., that's not a time to wind down, that's a time to step it up. And that image of the Rosh Yeshiva sitting there is something which I've taken with me for the last 50 years. Unbelievable. And why I tell you this is because this is what we're doing here on our Wednesday morning program. I was very excited. Maya Korosetso, again, should go to Rabbi Epstein for the support that he's given to this program, and for the shul, and for the organizers, the Millers, and various other people who, Rabbi Rothman, etc., who've taken on this program in such a positive way. And my hope is that this will be the start of a really inspiring learning experience. Every single week, it's not just another shiur, it's not just another few minutes that we do after here or before that. This is a real look at something, and we're going to go in, hopefully go into it in depth, go into it in some sort of realistic way, and ideally something, as you say in the yeshiva, chiddush, something new, something which should inspire you to say, wow, I've known this for so many years, and all of a sudden, the whole thing is completely different. So I was thinking to myself, okay, it's completely different. What does everybody know? What is everybody really aware of? I can't say that so much about sections of Gemara or Halacha, that's something we're always learning. But Megillat Esther, wow, from the years that one went to Hebrew school, from the years that you've been in shul over Purim time, Megillah, we've gone through it again and again and again. We're forced to read it twice every Purim, right? We sit through it. And it's fun. You know, everyone's waiting for Haman and to make a big noise, and my granddaughter, you know, dressed up, and my grandkids, and they can't wait for the excitement of the Megillah. And over the years, that's the way we've done Purim, year after year after year. And I think, I include myself in this, this is the way it always was. A few years ago, I had a very, very major encounter with someone in Eretz Yisrael called Rabbeinu Lau. Rabbeinu Lau is one of the real stars in the firmament of the rabbis in Israel today. He's a nephew of the chief rabbi, Rabbi Yisrael Lau, cousin of the present chief rabbi, David Lau's cousin. His father was the ambassador. If you haven't read the story of the Laus, you must. It's like the... Everybody says you've got to read the book about the prime ministers. Agree. The other book you've got to read is the book about Rav Lau. He wrote his autobiography, and it's about him and his brother that he came out of Belzen, and I think he was 8 years old when he came out of the camps, how he survived. A Russian soldier helped him to survive. It's an unbelievable story. And the brother who protected him, the older brother, Moti, I think his name was, Mordechai, Matityahu. He became an ambassador. The brother of Rav Lau became an ambassador, I think in Switzerland, Israeli ambassador. And his son, Rabbeinu, is really one of the big stars in Israel today. No question about it. He's very wanted on TV. He gives a lot of Torah lessons on the radio. I switched on, and now the beautiful thing, you get in the car, you can hear radio from around the world. So I tuned into Israeli radio, which is like 3 o'clock in the morning in Israel. What is it here? 7 o'clock in the evening. And Rav Lau is giving a shiur on the radio, 3 a.m. in the morning. Well, it's recorded, but 3 a.m. in the morning. So I thought, you know, that's really something. To get that in your car now is something, it's just the whole technology is incredible. The bottom line of what I'm going to tell you, what we're going to do, is we're going to look at Megillat Esther. We're going to look at the book of Esther, and we are going to revisit it all over again. And what we're going to do is something that I personally had not done till I heard Rav Lau's shiur on this particular subject, his shiurim. And what you've got to do is ask a very basic question. And it's not the question of what does this shekel and that drush and all the things that we've heard, and I'm not dismissing them, they're so important. Over the years we hear so much Torah on the book of Esther. It's incredible. What I want to do is to get, as Rav Lau says, a bit more reali. Reali means get more realistic. And ask the very basic question. The basic question is, when did this story take place? When? Not what happened, and not who is involved. We all know the names. Mordechai, Esther, Vashti, etc., etc. Chashverosh, the word name you can't pronounce easily. All of those names, all of those characters we know very well. But when did this story happen? That's the question which I don't think they asked, certainly not in Hebrew school. I don't remember being asked this question. And in yeshiva, for Vada, certainly never asked this question. And you know what? It really is significant. Because once you appreciate, once you understand when this story happened, the whole story takes on a different meaning. And I'm saying that, at the moment, I can't say more than by way of introduction, but I want you to be aware that what we're going to do is to change the way you look at the book of Esther. And it's really a life-changing experience. I warn you in advance. A good one, right? It's a good one. One has these things in life, and occasionally things you've taken for granted, all of a sudden, a new take, something different. And believe it or not, this not that this takes away from the interpretation, this enhances it. But it does challenge some of the basic understandings of the book of Esther. And I'll tell you what Rav Lau says in his introduction, and he says it so beautifully. He says like this, and the book, I don't think it's available in this country, Kriya Bamegila. You know, I picked this up in Israel, in a bookstore in Israel, and I was very delighted to find it, because I'd heard the Shiurim, but I hadn't seen the Sefer. It was published in 2013. What Rav Lau says is like this. He says, when you're a kid, as I said before, Purim, fantastic. The whole year you're working on, oh, half a year. Parents start panicking already before Purim. Before Hanukkah, they start panicking about the costume that you're going to wear. Right, the kids got to have costumes, and mothers go berserk, and you start visiting all these strange stores trying to find a good costume for the kids. And that's Purim at a very young age. What are you going to wear? What costume? Okay, you get a bit older, it goes through Bar Mitzvah, and all of a sudden Purim changes. Certainly for the guys. For the guys, it becomes a bit more about how to celebrate Purim. In, how should we say, the most halachically questionable way possible, imbibing certain liquids which you know you're not allowed to, but Purim, you make an exception. People start enjoying the celebration in a way which, let's put it very bluntly, leads much to be desired. We've been there and done it, and I include myself in that particular group. So Purim becomes a way of sort of, you know, Nichnas Yayin, this famous statement that everybody knows, the wine goes in, Yotza Sod, the secrets come out. Again, I remember my days in yeshiva being part of the crowd which enjoyed Purim in that particular style. And that lasts, again, for a number of years. Rav Lau, interestingly, a bit of his life history, he's just turned 60, just retired from his shul in Emek Rufaim. He was Rav of Kibbutz Lavi, which I have a very personal connection. My wife's grandmother is one of the founders of the kibbutz. We have a lot of family there, even to this day. And Rav Lau was the Rav there for a number of years. So he said, once he got over his yeshiva days, he went to the kibbutz as Rav, and all of a sudden, a whole different Purim. Purim became what he called Nesher. If you know the Hebrew term, it's whole preparation of the kibbutz, and they all get together, different spiels and different presentations. And this is very common in Israel, both on kibbutzim and in yeshuvim, and all over the place. And it's beautiful. It's a beautiful way of celebrating. It's done on family. Everyone with their family units, their family groupings come in. It's a fantastic experience. So he said that got him to around about 40 years old. Purim has been different stages of his life, different sorts of celebration. He said what changed his life was when he went to university to do a master's and then eventually a PhD. He went to Bar Ilan and all of a sudden Purim changed. And he said, he explains that Purim became he said, he uses the word mitra, tarud. It's something which bothered him. Because all of a sudden, when he was studying the text, oh, Megillat Esther, in the university, in that sort of setting, that academic and very Jewish setting, he began to ask questions which over the years he just felt either he should not ask or he was not able to ask, and things that bothered him began to be explained. And one of them, he said, was, when did the story take place? We've read the Gemaras, there's a lot of Gemara Megillah, which we're not going to go through in this class, but Gemara Megillah talks about the whole issue of the Galut, the 70 years of exile. And the Gemara makes a whole big deal about all the different calculations of these 70 years. It was known that there would be 70 years of exile, but the question is, when do those 70 years happen? When do they take place? Just excuse me a second, I'll give some more papers. What if it's across the back? So, again, the Gemara is concerned with this. The question of the 70 years of exile of the Jewish people. We know that in the Sefer Yirmiyahu, in the book of Jeremiah, the prediction of 70 years was made. And it wasn't specified from when to when. So what has happened in terms of the Talmudic debate is the discussion of when those 70 years were up. Achashverosh made a mistake, and it describes all the other kings that also made their particular calculation. And what Rav Benny does is he goes back to basics, and this is the page you have in front of you, and he asks the question initially, when were the 70 years of exile from when to when? And if you put that into the initial discussion, you'll then get to a point in Jewish history when you can start dealing with the Purim story. And I'll explain. Purim is not happening in Israel. Everybody knows. It's happening in Persia, Shushan. I actually worked with somebody, not Jewish, many years ago, who came back from a visit to Tehran. Now, it's not a place where I think Jews would be willing to go. I don't think any Americans should go there either, for lots of very fundamental reasons. But this young lady came back and she showed me pictures of the tombs of Mordechai and Esther. Very interesting. And it's a holy place. It's protected by the government over there, believe it or not. They are buried there. People even go to pray there. I don't think Jews. Maybe Jews when they were living there still would, but now I don't know who goes there. But the tombs are protected. I saw photos of it. The reality of the story of Purim is that it's happening outside Eretz Yisrael. And it's obviously happening to a community which is in the Galut. The community is in the diaspora. And if we accept, as we all have, that this is a community in the diaspora, then we have to ask the question of which period of diaspora Jewry did this story take place? Did it take place, for instance, before the Jews started returning to Eretz Israel, as I'll show you on the page, which we're going to look at in a moment? Or did it take place after they started returning? But, as you know from Jewish history, I hope many of you do know, the return at the beginning was not successful. In the beginning, when the Jews went back after the initial period of exile, we are told that very few Jews went. Majority stayed in Bavel, in Babylon, where they were exiled to. They didn't go back. They just did not go back. And we'll find out, we'll read a little bit about that in a minute. And of course, the question then is, if they didn't go back, is the story of Purim happening before that decision not to go back? Or is the story of Purim happening after the decision not to go back? And I'll explain what I mean by looking at the page in front of you. This is a handout which the middle of the page, as I said to you, is the important thing. You've got page 1, and on the back, the continuation of page 2. And what Rav Lau does, and it's so beautiful, and again, other rabbis I've seen also go into this, what he does is he takes us through a timeline. And he takes us through a little bit of Jewish history. And this is what we've got to do, and just bear with me. Some of these names you will know. I'm going to try and make it as simple as I can. We all know the temple was destroyed. The first temple, Nebuchadnezzar, the date that's usually put on it, I put it on the page here, 586 BCE. Don't ask me for the Jewish dates, I really don't know. You have to work those numbers out. But I usually find 586 is a bit more meaningful for most people. Fine, that was the destruction of the temple. But in essence, did the exile begin in 586? Or did it begin earlier? And when you look at Sefer Tanakh, at the moment I'm teaching in YU, Sefer Melachim Bet, you'll see that the story of exile really kicked off essentially about 30 years earlier. And what do I mean? There was a king called Yoshiyahu, King Josiah. King Josiah was a tzaddik. The man was an incredible person. He also grew up in a world in Israel where there was not even a Sefer Torah. Can you believe it? Not one Sefer Torah in the whole country. There was no Judaism, organized Judaism to speak of. The country was steeped in idolatry. And all of a sudden, Yoshiyahu, King Josiah, discovers, or is shown a Sefer Torah that they found a little winkle, a little corner somewhere in the Beit HaMikdash. They found a Sefer Torah. And the Kohen Gadol brings it to Yoshiyahu, and they open the Sefer Torah, and it's at the section of the Tochacha, the rebukes, that we read a few weeks ago. And Yoshiyahu turns white. He hears it, and he says, "What is this? What is all this saying? What is this about?" And the high priest said, "This is what it says in the Torah." And he says, "What's the Torah?" This is truly unbelievable. This was the situation in Israel. And after he explains to him what the Tochacha is about, Yoshiyahu says, "We've got to do something about it. This is saying to us, if we don't return to God, the land is going to be destroyed. The temple is going to be destroyed." And Yoshiyahu was the last Jewish king to attempt to reverse the situation. Idolatry was a real problem. They loved idolatry. I'm not going to go into it now, but there's a lot to say about that. We don't really understand it because we don't have any affinity to worship idols. But once upon a time, they really did. And Yoshiyahu decided he's going to reverse the situation. He makes a Korban Pesach, a public Paschal Lamb offering. We read the Haftarah. We actually read it on Pesach about that story. And never, he goes to war with Egypt. Plus Hashon, you know, nothing changes in the Middle East. And what happened was that at the age of 33, Yoshiyahu is killed in battle. Tragedy. If you look on your sheet, number one, the death of Yoshiyahu, in English Josiah, is according to whatever opinion historically you want to take, consensus 609 BCE. That's the death of Josiah. And for many, says Rav Lau, this is the beginning of the 70 years of Galut. Because as soon as Josiah died, the enemy starts moving into Israel en masse, the Babylonians, etc. And you go just down to 597, you've got what is called Galut Yehoyachin, the Galus of the king Yehoyachin. He was a king in Eretz Israel, one of the last kings, and he was taken out. It says with his mother, you've got this section over here in the Hebrew, above and below the line, which is taken from, I'm pretty sure, from Sefer Melachim. And it tells what happened in that terrible exile. Basically, what Rav Lau argues is that although 597 was an exile from Israel, 609 was the beginning of it. Because that's when Josiah was killed. Once Josiah went, Yoshiyahu was gone, the country fell into terrible, terrible problems in terms of the enemy attacking. They were already in exile. Even if they were in Israel, they were already beginning the Galut. They were leaving. They were being taken away. And if you just look very quickly at the text of A on the page, I'll just read it through, where it says, Ba'etahi alu avdei Nebuchadnezzar, melech Bavel, Yerushalayim, that the king Nebuchadnezzar came to Jerusalem, he started a siege. He came against the city. They surrounded it. And the king after Josiah was taken out. He took his mum. Doesn't say he took his dad. His mum came with. I'm glad to see that, but he was worried about his mother. Vavadav, Vesarav, all of his servants, they were all schlepped out of Yerushalayim. Sarisav, his people serving him. Vayikach oto melech Bavel, Vishnat Shmoni Lamoko, and the king of Babylon took them away to Babylon. Nowadays, Iraq. That's where they went. And it says further, Posek Yud Gimel, the sixth line on section A, Yotzei Misham et kol otzrot Beit Hashem, they took all the gold from the house of God, Otsrot Beit HaMelech, Vayikatzetz et kol klei hazahav, asher asah Shlomo. Shlomo was big into gold. He was man of gold. And everything was made from gold, and it was stored in the storehouses of the temple. Nebuchadnezzar comes along, and schleps it all out, takes it to Babylon. Unbelievable. If you go down the page, you'll see section B, where it's underlined, that verse, Tetvav, that verse, which is the second line of section B, Vayogel et Yoyachim Bavela, he went to Babylon, Yoyachim, Bet Eim HaMelech and his mother, Bet Neshei HaMelech, his wives, etc. Sarisa, Bet Elei HaAretz, Holich Gola, Yushalayim Bavela. Tragedy. The exile was in full flight. And he explains also that his men were taken away. They basically, Eretz Yisrael was emptied out of the men, the fighters, the army, whoever could have stood up against Nebuchadnezzar, and they left behind what they called Amei Haaretz. Amei Haaretz is an expression which is used today. Slightly derogatory. Call someone Amei Haaretz is not a nice thing to say. Usually referring to a person not knowing very much. Once upon a time, Amei Haaretz literally meant men of the earth. Right? They were farmers. They left behind a farming and agricultural community in Israel, and that's the whole story. Gedalia, etc., etc. So basically, if you go to the timeline, you'll see that from 609, when Josiah died, through 597, which is this paragraph that we've just read, with the exile of Yoyachin, we're well into the 70 years, this is an opinion, we're well into the 70 years of the exile. If it says there's going to be an exile for 70 years, starts at 609 and goes through 597, which is the traditional date for Yoyachin, and through 586, which is the date of the first temple being destroyed. Now, do your math. If you're going to take the number 70 from 609, minus, remember the numbers there go down because it's BCE, before the Common Era, you're going to go down to 539. Right? And that's right in the middle of the page. What happened in the year 539? It's documented in the book of, essentially the book of Ezra, and you read the Sefer Ezra, Sefer Nehemiah, you'll read all of this information. And what happened then was a nes, a miracle. The miracle was that the leader of the Persian Empire, Koresh in Hebrew, in English known as Cyrus. One of the things I hope you'll do when you leave this shiur and go home is to start using what I call Google, for those who are into Googling. Right? Apparently there is a verb now. To Google, you Google. Right? Even in Ivrit, ani magugal, I was Googled. Right? Apparently that's a new Hebrew word. The whole idea of going and doing a bit of research, because it's fascinating. Right? The moment, we're not talking about Megillat Esther, we're talking about world history. You're back in ninth grade, but don't worry about it. It's interesting. What we're going to say is the following. The 70 years of exile began with the death of Josiah. That, for all intents and purposes, was the end of the first Commonwealth of Israel. The exile Jews started being taken away. And you get to 539, and it's right in the middle of page 1. Cyrus conquers Babylon. Nebuchadnezzar was the big chief, and read the book of Daniel, and you'll see what a meshuggah this man really was. Eventually became like a dog, kekeleb. Don't ask, it's crazy stuff. And after he's gone, Cyrus, the emperor of Persia, takes over Babylon. This is Middle East politics. You know, again, look at the world around the Middle East today. Nothing really changes. They're all after each other's countries. The reality of it is that Cyrus was really an incredible man. Cyrus's policy, King Koresh, his policy was not like Nebuchadnezzar, bring all the exiles to Babylon, Bavel, Lashom, Lebalbel, to mix everybody up. Cyrus's policy was, let's put them back in situ. You know what? They are people that deserve to have their own freedom, their own autonomy. Let's send back groups where we got them from. Remember, he probably conquered from all over the Middle East. Let's send them back to places like Israel. Let's send them back to, who knows, Syria, wherever he got the people from. And therefore, in 539, there is this Hatzarat Koresh, famous. It's written in the Bible. You have to go home and read the book of Ezra, you'll see. And Koresh, Cyrus says, announces that the Jews can go back to Yerushalayim. Wow. Imagine. It's something which should have, you know, it's the equivalent. What am I going to compare it to? The Balfour Declaration, 1917. Balfour Declaration was made in such a way that people were just overwhelmed. This, for many, was the announcement of Mashiach, because it meant that the Jews would have their own homeland in the land of Israel. 1917. Of course, there was a long way to go from there, but it was the first step. Koresh, Cyrus, in his day, did a similar thing. He announced that the Jews can go back to Eretz Israel in the year 539. 1 year later, and it goes right to the end of the page, you've got a situation where the Jews are saying the Kehillah in Bavel and around the Middle East, outside Eretz Israel, Sholom and I Nafshi, we don't want to go. It's too comfortable. It's too easy for us. Right? They settled into Bavel, they settled into all the countries they did. They started making money. Jews are good at making money, we know this. And all of a sudden, life became a bit more tolerable. To go back to Israel, to that desert, to that wasteland, no, they're not going. And it's unreal. For one whole year, this announcement was, there was like an amnesty, you can go, you can stop being subservient to us in Bavel, and the majority of the Jews decided not to go. It's incredible. Look at the comment on the right-hand side. The Jews do not listen to proclamation of Cyrus. So Josiah dies in 609, 70 years after destruction of the independent Jewish state, and the first Aliyah, 538. A number do go. There's always going to be what we call Chalutzin. Right? We know this. We know in the 1920s and the 1930s of our time period, people did go. My wife's uncle went to a place called Kfar Ro'eh. In 1934, he left Germany, middle of nowhere, and he built the most fantastic farm, and unbelievable what he did there. And it took a certain amount of craziness, no question about it. And there were certain groups that went. How do we know about this group? Because it's a Haftarah, you all know. The Haftarah of Chanukah. Roni v'Simchi Bas Tzion. That Haftarah, which talks about the rejoicing of the daughter of Zion, that's the time period of the Jews going back, beginning to go back to Eretz Israel. Now, if you're still with me in the historical framework, and I've got here a comment of the Kuzari, which on the right-hand side, he talks about this whole time period when the Jews were allowed to go and they did not want to go. And the Kuzari says it very, very scary what he says. I'll just read this paragraph on the right. He says, Ha'avon azeh, the sin of not going back, hu asher mananu meshlamat ma sheyadanu bo. Elohim, the Beit Sheni, we just were not finishing the second temple. It's the page one on the right hand side, the top paragraph. Kamoshene ma kuzari, I don't want to have to go into explain, Judah Levi, philosopher of the Middle Ages, one of the greats. In fact, he made Aliyah, the legend, we're not sure if it's true, he got to the gates of Jerusalem, he bowed down to kiss the floor, outside the Shah Yafo, and an Arab saw him and trampled him to death on his horse. Unbelievable. He came from Spain, he got to Eretz Israel, we don't know where he's buried, I don't think there's any marker of his grave, and that is the legend. Yehuda Levi, one of the real great poets, great philosophers of the Jewish world of the Middle Ages, from the Spanish school. He writes about this whole story of the Jews not going back after Cyrus. Listen to this. Second line. Shenemash Roni v'Simchi Bat Zion, there was a chance to rejoice. Basically, the whole thing of rebuilding the second temple, the project was happening. But the condition was we all had to go back. With a desire to go. Aval shavu miktzatam, says the Kuzari, only a few went back. Nisharu rubam. It says the big rabbis, they didn't want the Jew to go to Palestine. Where did we hear that? Don't go to Palestine. Trade for Medina. Don't go to America either. Stay in Europe. Everything will be fine. We've heard that language somewhere else. And he says that they didn't go. Gedoleihem, the great leaders. But Bavel, Rotzim, Begalut, they were comfortable in the exile. Ubavuda, Shaloi, Pardum, in Mishkanotehem. They lived in what they call now, this wonderful expression in America, Mac Mansions, equivalent. They lived in nice places. And if you just turn over the page, there's a continuation of the Kuzari, where he basically says at the bottom, in it's number 3, on the left-hand side of page 2, the flip side of your handout, Al Ezra Shaya Potser Bahem, who changed the sinat, the scene, to get the Jews to go back? Ezra. Ezra was a great rabbinic leader, and he said to them, Nechemiah Nevi'im, Ad Shahodu Mitzatam Lashuv. Then a few more came, and the temple was built. So what we are saying, if you just, again, go back to the first side of the pen, so I'm flipping you from one side to the other. We've basically got 70 years of exile, 609 down to 539. We've got then 1 year where the Jews are allowed to go, and a few of them go, but very few. The middle section here are just Pesukim, which I'm not going to go through now, from Sefer Yechezkel, where he talks about groups which stayed in Babylon, why they were, and he criticizes them. Yechezkel didn't mince his words, a prophet who was with them in Babylon. The whole story is a very difficult story. Again, turn over to page 2 and we'll finish the page. What happens, and you'll see the line again continues 538 in the middle of page 2. At that point, says Rav Lam, there is between that moment when the first Aliyah seems to fail, people are not returning, and the time when Ezra and Nehemiah do bring the Jews back, there's a gap. He says the gap is in fact, because we know the date of Ezra's around 473, that again is a historical given, you have to sort of do the research on that, but most people say it's around the 470s, in which case, Rabbeni says, 65 years, he calls it Chor Shachor. There's like a black hole of time. And we don't know what's going on. There's not much written about that period of time. There's not much that we find in our sources. There's not much archaeological stuff. It's very strange. And during that black hole of time, between 538 and 473, Rabbeni says, that's when the Purim story took place. I'll say it again. That's when the Purim story took place. If that's the case, think about it for a second. We're talking about a community in exile. We're talking about a community that, we've just heard from the Kuzari, were very comfortable in their galut, in their diaspora. They clearly were not religiously inspired. One could even suggest, and this is going to be one of the radical suggestions, that we know this is true, there was a lot of assimilation. They had a very big intermarriage in Babylon at the beginning. In which case, what are we talking about when we are saying the Purim story is happening to a community in this situation? Are we talking about a dedicated religious community? Shushan, etc. Or are we talking about an assimilated community? From what I just presented to you, the answer has to be, someone be brave, it's definitely going to be assimilated. That's a big shock to the system. Because you know what we're going to say? And this, I hope, you're not going to walk out when I say this. Mordechai and Esther, I have my little granddaughter here, 6 years old, right? The bakers know her very well. She's dressed up as Queen Esther, very excited. So along comes Zadig, and he says, you know what, don't get so excited about Esther, I'm going to tell you the truth. I would never do this, because that will destroy her whole belief, and the whole holiday would go down the drain. What we're going to say is that the community of Shushan was an assimilated community. Not all the way through the story, but at the beginning. If we accept that that is possible, then we are going to have a completely different view of the story of Esther. The story of Esther and Mordechai is about an assimilated community in this period of time, the 65 years, before we get to the return of the Jews to Eretz Israel. And we've already seen that the group that Cyrus wanted to go back did not take up the challenge at the beginning. And in fact, the project of building the temple, if you read the story, was started and then it was stopped. And it was stopped for a number of years. In Israel, things were not happening. It wasn't very great what was going on. And outside Eretz Israel, in the community of Shushan, the cosmopolitan assimilated community of Shushan, we are dealing with that period of time, with that community, and I'm going to add with the leadership of that community. I'm going to ask you a simple question. We all know this. Where was Mordechai sitting at the beginning of the story when we come across Mordechai? Chapter 2. Where does he say he sits? Gates of the king. Right? So we all think about this for a second. And we say he's sitting by the gates of the king. What's that the equivalent of? He's got an office in the Congress. He's got an office in London, it'd be in Whitehall. Right? Somewhere near the seat of power. What does that suggest about Mordechai? That suggests that he's the rabbi, the Rosh Yeshiva, sitting in the Mir, or in Ponovich, or Gateshead, or Lakewood. Is he that sort of person? Or is he the person sitting close to the circle of power because, dare I say it, maybe he's got himself into the good books of the powerful, the leaders. Maybe he's closer to the Persian leadership. Maybe Mordechai, for all intents and purposes, at the beginning of the story, not by the end, but at the beginning of the story is, and I'll probably get shot down for saying this, an assimilated Jew. That's a pretty shocking thing to realize. Maybe we're dealing with Mordechai not as the quintessential rabbinic leader, which the Talmud obviously presents him, the way it presents him. That's fair enough. That's a whole different presentation. We're talking about Mordechai as the internet, so the guy who goes and becomes part of the government. It's very shocking, because I tell you, there's another ramification here. We all ask the question, I'm just throwing out here what we've said so far, what difference it makes to part of the story. Esther is told one thing from Mordechai, one command. What was her command? What was she not allowed to do? Everyone knows the story. Not allowed to say, she's Jewish. Think about it. Mordechai is in with the big guys. And Esther, his niece, is now in a position where Vashti is gone. We're going to go over all of this when we go through the story. And all of a sudden, you know what happened? Esther has an opportunity also to get in with the crowd, her uncle. According to most opinions, he's her uncle. Some say he's married, but I'll leave that for another time. Her uncle wants to bring her in. What would be the last thing she would announce if she wanted to get a job at that higher level of government, that she's Jewish? We all know in America, come here 50, 60 years ago, and you announce you were Jewish, it wasn't a very good thing for you to step up into certain higher levels of the running of the country. It just was not going to happen if you were Jewish. Now we're living in a country, strange things going on around here, but the reality is that at least being of an ethnic minority doesn't necessarily preclude you from becoming more attached to the leadership. That I think is true really almost around the world. Yes.
Nobody's bothering me now, but doesn't this go against everything that Haman was telling Ahasuerus about the Jews?
Correct. And the whole thing about Haman and his beef with the Jews, and we're particularly Mordechai, may now not necessarily be an act of great anti-Semitism, we always saw it, but it may be a personal vendetta that he has against Mordechai. Everybody knows the story. I'm going to shock you. I'm glad it's bothering you, because that's the right word to use. If you come out of this shit and you're not bothered, then I haven't done my job. My teacher always told me this, and it's really true. You're going to go home and say, wait a minute, that wasn't the book of Esther that I know from school, from shul and from everywhere else. But we've got to get real. And I'm getting real because I want you to understand the following. We all know the story about Mordechai and Haman meeting in the army. Everybody seems to know that midrash. It's one of the famous stories. Mordechai was in the army and Haman was at what army? Not the Israelis, it wasn't Saha. This was the Persian army, for goodness sake. What was Mordechai doing in the Persian army? He was not a chaplain in the army, he was a general. He was, again, was saying he's connected to the leadership. He's a general in the Persian army. And who comes to him? The lieutenant, you know, the guy beneath him, Haman. And Haman says to him, Mordechai, I'm here and I need money. And Mordechai lends him money, and there's a whole midrash. Again, we're going to deal with this in more detail in the next couple of weeks. And as a result, Haman gives Mordechai an IOU, and the IOU is worthless, etc. And basically what Mordechai says to Haman is, I am now your boss. You may be a different rank in the army, we may not be necessarily connected with our plugot, our army units, but I am your boss. Haman hated Mordechai. Was that animosity against Mordechai the Jew or Mordechai the human being? You can speculate. And you know what? The beginning, we actually, if we read the text closely, we may find that Haman's initial way of being so anti-Mordechai is because he hated him for what he did to him in the army. And we asked the obvious question, what's Mordechai doing in the army? He's a Rosh Yeshiva, he should have a patur like they do in Israel. The answer is no. Because Mordechai at the beginning, I've given two proofs, and maybe there are more, that were dealing not necessarily with the image of Mordechai that we've all grown up with. He may not at the beginning have been who we think he was. He was not the great rabbinic figure. He may have become that by the end, but at the beginning we're dealing with an assimilated community and with an assimilated leadership. And if we get all of that and put it into perspective, the whole story takes on such a different twist. It's beyond belief. I'm just looking at the time. We've got a few more minutes. And I just want to show you the end of the page that I've given you. Look at this. If you're now on page 2, just to recoup what we said. 538, the Mikdash is dedicated by Zerubbabel. And Yeshua, as he's called, the high priest, not yet finished. And when you read the story of what happened, the temple was, really the whole project was put on hold. Right? You know, you had the fence around, and you had the big notice which was fading because already the years were passing by and the donations were not there, the people were not there, and it was done. I just want to say one thing from modern Jewish history, which is one of my real regrets. The 1967 war was incredible. The miracles of the Six-Day War still, I guess, so much of it we don't even still know about. And one of the incredible moments of the Six-Day War was the conquering of Yerushalayim and taking of the Beit HaMikdash. The Arabs were running. They weren't there. It wasn't like today where you step one toe inside the Temple Mount and start throwing stones at you and try and kill you. They were gone. The whole temple was vacated. Rabbi Shlomo Goren, the chief rabbi of the army at the time, eventually the chief rabbi of Israel, went to Moshe Dayan. And he writes this in his book. And he says, Dayan, higia zaman livnot bayit shlishi. The time has come to build the third temple. That was Goren's pitch. And Dayan listened to him, and he said, lo, with an aleph, no. Lo higia zaman. And he said, why is it not the time? And Dayan said, because the world won't accept it. World opinion. And we know what world opinion is about because we've been suffering from world opinion for the last 60, 70 years. The reality was at that moment, it was a messianic moment. No question in my mind. I was in 10th grade in school and I was getting it. I really saw this was something. Had I been in 12th grade or 13th grade, as they say, I would have been on a plane to Israel volunteering, as a lot of my friends did. The reality of it was that that was a messianic moment which was missed. In the story of Purim, the first return, 538, according to the law of Cyrus, that again was a messianic moment, and it was missed. The Jews just did not come back in numbers. Even when they did, does anyone know how many Jews came back to build the second temple eventually? How many Jews were in Israel? The number which is shocking. We're not talking nowadays. How many Jews in Israel? The last census? 7 million. How many built the second temple? Just to put it in perspective. Throw out a number. Anybody?
100,000.
Almost there. Bit more. Sorry, excuse me. Bit less. 40,000 Jews. 40,000 Jews. And they built the second temple. And we've got 7 million Yidden. And we can't build the third temple.
How did they get money out of a small group?
They brought money with them. They obviously, it said, one of the interesting things is that before they left Israel, they secured some of their possessions and their land. They wrote documents, and when they knew that their children or grandchildren would come back, because they believed that 70 years was going to be over, they could recoup whatever was taken for away from them, they got it back. And that's the book of Jeremiah. You'll see there's a whole section there where they prepared to come back. 40,000 Jews. And we're sitting in Eretz Yisrael today, 7 million Jews. And we're still waiting. We're waiting for the United Nations. And we'll be waiting forever. Waiting for the world to allow us to do it. It's so frustrating. As I said, one of my frustrations. That in essence, we are not building the third temple yet. It's going to happen very soon. We really believe that. But in the meantime, what we see from the lesson of the second temple is that there are messianic moments, there are opportunities, and lo aleinu, God forbid, when it comes to it and we miss the opportunity, we suffer for a very long time. In 538, the opportunity was missed. It took another 65 years. That meant that for those 65 years, the community in Israel was struggling. A few thousand Jews, maybe, I don't know, few pockets of Jews here, a few in the north, few in Yerushalayim, who knows where they were, and it never happened. The diaspora became stronger, and the community in Israel was very weak. In that period of time, and this is the Chiddush for today, I think it's probably enough, the Chiddush for today is that during that dark period, as I said, Rav Lau calls it the Chor Shachor, the black hole of time, that's when the Purim story took place. And the Purim story revolves around a community that not only within itself was assimilated, but had disconnected initially from Eretz Israel. And that is again part of the story we know. Beginning, the parties, we're going to talk about the parties next week. I always like to talk about parties, it's a happy subject to talk about. We'll talk about the parties next week because we know at the beginning of the story of Purim, they went to a party, the whole Jewish community. Right? There was a scandal in 1888. Reform movement in America had their first meeting in Cincinnati, wherever it was, and they served treifas on Yom Kippur. Right? And that became a shocking event, it's recorded, and everybody got really, really upset except the Reform movement, which made a statement at that time. I think they've been backtracking ever since. But the reality is, in Shushan, that was what happened. The whole Jewish community went to the Suda, and it was treifas. And nobody would, and where's Mordechai? He's not standing at the door. Shrine Gevalt doesn't seem to be there. The whole atmosphere of Shushan at the beginning of the Purim story is an atmosphere of assimilation. The community had intermarried, and this is again documented in so much of the Tanakh. The people were disconnected from Eretz Israel, and in the middle of all of that, the whole story of Purim takes place. That, again, for today, as I said, is probably enough, but I just want to throw in one more item for you to think about, Bezrat Hashem, for next week. And that is the world history angle about the Persian Empire. We've spoken here about the Galut, we've spoken about the 70 years, when it started, when it finished, we've spoken about the placing of the story of Purim historically in that dark period of time. This was a suggestion from various professors in Bar-Ilan and other places, and I go with it. As I said, this is not set in stone. You can disagree with everything I've just said, but I'm throwing out an idea because it really changes the story. I think it makes the story incredibly powerful. I have to say, and I should have said this at the beginning, by learning it with this historical perspective, the story becomes even more amazing than it ever was in the past. I really am excited about it. But nevertheless, we're dealing initially with an assimilated community. They failed to live up to that messianic moment to build the second temple. And as I said, I think of 1967 in the same way. And we're getting to a situation where all of a sudden the Jews in Persia but the whole of the Persian Empire, all of a sudden become threat. And that will obviously something that we need to look at, something that we need to think about for next week, is the threat where it comes from, Ahasuerus. Ahasuerus is translated in English as Xerxes. Xerxes, that's usually the name of the gentleman. There are a number of them, like Pharaoh was a generic name. Xerxes, Artaxerxes, are all different leaders that had that title. But what is so fascinating is who this guy Ahasuerus really was, his hold on, his sway on the empire. The whole beginning of the Purim story will take on a whole new meaning. Bezrat Hashem, next week, what we'll do is we'll do a bit of background. We're still literally preambling here. We haven't even got to the book yet. But we're preambling the Sefer because we've seen what the Jewish community was like. one version of it. Now I want to show you what the non-Jewish leadership was like. Ahasuerus, the people around him, what was going on in Shushan that was happening around this time, which made the whole Purim story in a way come about. It wasn't just an internal Jewish event, it was an event which was controlled by external events as well. And that is an incredible thing. I just want to recognize my son just walked in from Baltimore, Kol HaKavod. Wow, thank you so much. And I just want to sort of finish with that analysis, something for you to go away, maybe, as I said, to Google, to find out about King Xerxes. Go and look on your, you know, your smartphones or whatever you have, put in the search Xerxes and find out about the battles that Xerxes had in his empire at that particular period of time that we're talking about, between the years 538. In fact, Ahasuerus became the king in 486 because Cyrus was king for a number of years. Somebody else took over after him, and then Ahasuerus was, I think, the third one in line. So find out about him, and when we put these two sides together of the equation, of the puzzle, as it were, we'll begin to get a much bigger picture of what the Purim story is about, Bezrat Hashem, and we will be able to then go into the story of Purim, I hope, with renewed energy. I really am looking forward to this. I really appreciate your listening. Thank you, everybody. Have a great day. Thank you so much.